puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
And we are back to abandoned Manitoba this morning. I'm joined now by Gordon Goldsborough from the Manitoba Historical Society. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, Nadja.
Now, before we get to your actual segment today, there is a significant event that's coming up.
Right. A little bit of sad news, in fact. 2 weeks ago, one of Manitoba's most prominent historians, J.M. Bumstead, passed away after quite a lengthy illness. And I thought listeners might want to know that he had passed, and that next Saturday, the 15th, there's going to be a memorial service for Jack here in Winnipeg.
Can you tell us a little bit more about him and his contributions?
Right, yeah. So he was an American. He was born in New York State, but he came to Canada in 1965. He was a historian. He came first to British Columbia to teach history at Simon Fraser University, but he came here to Manitoba in 1980 to teach at the University of Manitoba. And he stayed there basically until his retirement in 2007. Over a long and distinguished academic career, Jack wrote over 30 popular and scholarly books on various aspects of Canadian history. There was ones on the Red River Rebellion, on the Winnipeg General Strike, the flood of 1950, and numerous others. And perhaps his most noteworthy accomplishment was that he was the recognized authority on Lord Selkirk. And of course, Lord Selkirk brought the Scottish settlers here who ultimately developed much of Manitoba. So that was pretty significant. And he received numerous awards over the course of his life, Jack did. He served as the president of the Manitoba Historical Society. And I worked with Jack quite closely during that period. So I knew him pretty well. And it was really sad to see him go. But before he died, listeners may be familiar with Jack as the proprietor of the Who Done It bookstore here in Winnipeg that specialized in sort of mystery novels and such. Fortunately, that store is going to carry on with his family, and so there is an ongoing legacy. But if listeners do want to sort of pay their last respects to Jack, Saturday, the 15th of February, 11 a.m. at St. George's Anglican Church here in Winnipeg.
First of all, I'm sorry for your loss, a friend of yours, but it seems like a really important part of the community here in terms of those who appreciate local history.
Right, exactly. And I would say that he was one of the most significant historians of this generation.
Now, remind us of the clue from last week for this week's Abandoned Manitoba segment.
Yeah. I said that for several decades, the building we were going to talk about today hosted Manitoba's two favorite winter sports. And I'm sure listeners got what those two would be. Of course, they would include hockey. And I think the other one was pretty obvious, too. It would be
curling.
Of course. Right. Yeah. And so the building we're talking about is an abandoned indoor ice rink at Griswold, Manitoba, which is located right along the Trans-Canada Highway, about 25 miles west of Brandon.
So are you telling me that you're doing a sports story today on Abandoned Manitoba?
Well, anybody who knows me knows that I'm not a big sports guy. But partly it is a sports story. You know, skating rinks were an important feature of many Manitoba communities, you know, and especially in the years before we had such distractions as radio, television, the internet. You know, most communities of any size had a place for recreational skating, and you know, it was also used for competitive sports like hockey and curling.
You said this is only partly a sports story. What
right.
else does it touch on?
Well, I think it's also really an engineering story, because if you think about what it took to play hockey and curling in the early days of Manitoba, of course, you needed ice. And of course, this is typically found on frozen rivers and lakes. You know, so if you wanted to play those sports, you know, first of all, you had to wait until the ice was strong enough to support your weight. And you can only play where there was a river and a lake. So if you were living in a town that didn't have a river or a lake, well, you were kind of out of luck. Unless you took, of course, some water and you poured it on some land, let it freeze, and then, of course, you'd have an on-land rink. And so that's what a lot of communities did. It was, of course, a problem that you, whenever it snowed, of course, the ice would be covered in snow. You'd have to shovel that away. So an indoor ice surface would be a big improvement. And these began to be developed around the turn of the 20th century.
When was the rink at Griswold built then?
Well, I found a reference to the first rink at Griswold in the community's history book, and it says that the first curling and skating rink was built in 1899. But this was an outdoor facility. It actually took another 29 years, not until 1928, did Griswold have an indoor rink.
Why didn't they just go for an indoor rink from the start?
Well, the problem, especially if you want an ice surface for hockey, you know, where you need a large area that is free of obstacles, well, you know, imagine you have to support a roof over top of an indoor facility with some sort of support. And, of course, you don't want to have pillars in the middle of the ice. Can you imagine the mayhem if the skaters had to skate around a bunch of posts on the ice surface? Well, that doesn't work. So instead, what you need are roof trusses. A truss is a structure that supports a roof. If you imagine, you know, roof trusses that could span the entire ice surface. And that was, of course, a fairly big area. You know, steel would be the preferred material for such trusses, but it's pretty expensive. And especially if you're in a small community, you don't have a lot of resources. You know, if you're on a strict budget, well, steel's probably out of the budget. Wooden trusses, well, they're a little bit less expensive, but they're not especially strong. And because of the imperfections in wood, you know, the natural grains and so on, they're not especially strong unless you make them really, really thick. And, well, then they become expensive. So it's not really an ideal solution. So a lot of the early buildings, in fact, were constrained in their size by the fact that you just couldn't get trusses big enough and cheap enough, you know, to support the loads of the roof.
What kind of trusses does this Griswold rink have?
Well, it has wooden ones, but they're ones that are quite interesting. So if you look inside, you'll find large, straight, solid wood beams that run up at an angle up to the peak of the roof. And the roofing material, the boards for the roof itself, the shingles on the roof and so on, they're supported by these boards. But then underneath those beams, supporting the weight essentially, are some really graceful curving beams that are made of many layers of thin wood. In other words, not big thick pieces, but thin pieces that are all sandwiched together in a big, big thick sandwich. And to make these beams, the carpenters would have had to bend the wood slowly and gently so that it wouldn't break. They sometimes used things like steam to help bend them. And then to make sure that the sandwich stayed together, well, they would strengthen the beam and they would hold it together with big metal bolts. They would drill holes along the length of these curved beams, put these metal bolts in and tighten them up. And that was really what provided the strength, were these graceful curving arches. Well, the Griswold rink was built in 1928, but if it had been built just 20 years later in the 1940s, I suspect the technique for making its trusses would have been much different. And as a result, the trusses would have been much stronger than the ones that are actually there.
Why? What happened during those 20 years?
Well, in the 1940s, there was a major advance in the construction of roof trusses, and it was attributable to a pair of brothers at Boisevain, guys named George and Arthur Dring. Now, they had emigrated here from England in 1922, and in the 1930s, they supported themselves as carpenters. They went around Western Manitoba building all kinds of buildings, barns and houses and churches and schools. And during the Second World War, Arthur Dring observed that there was a newly designed British bomber called a Mosquito. And the unique thing about the Mosquito is that it was made almost entirely of wood. But not just any wood. They had actually taken laminated pieces of wood and glued them together rather than nailing them, because, of course, in a plane, you need to have as light a plane as possible. They had glued the pieces together, and they made very strong laminated beams. And so Arthur Dring said, hey, we could use that approach to build buildings. So in 1943, the Drings made their very first glued truss for use in building barns. Now, they were pioneers in this respect, you know, that nobody had done this before them. And there were people that were a little suspicious. You know, if you're holding together just with glue, is it going to be strong enough? So, in fact, in the first few years, they actually had to add nails, not because it was necessary to hold the beam together, but just because people were a little worried that a glued beam wouldn't hold together and it would come crashing down on them. Eventually, once it became abundantly clear that the glue was, in fact, just as good, in fact, better, it was found that this laminated beam was both stronger and harder than a solid wooden beam of the same dimensions. And in fact, with the glue set properly, it's almost as strong as steel. You know, so you've got the cost factor of the wood, But the strength factor of the steel, it's perfect. You know, and so in 1947, the Dring brothers constructed a factory at Boisvain, and they began to manufacture these laminated trusses that went all over Canada. They went into the United States. Well, in fact, by the 1960s, their company was the largest employer in Boisvain, and it's still in operation today. Today, those are known as glue lambs trusses, and churches and arenas and other structures all over Manitoba have these Dring glue lambs in them. And so although the one in Griswold is just the precursor to that, it gives you an insight to the virtues, the engineering virtues of building things on a curve.
I love that little side story. Fascinating. But back to the Griswold rink. What happened to that?
Well, in the old days, when the roads were not quite so good, having a rink at every community made sense. But as the roads improved and it became more feasible to travel further to a nearby community, the smaller, older rinks were abandoned. So in the case of Griswold, I suspect that it was doomed by two factors. First, there was the construction of a separate curling rink in town in 1967. And the second was the construction of a new indoor rink at Oak Lake, just 7 miles away in 1972. I'm told that the last use of the Griswold rink was in the 1980s, and since then, the roof and the walls are now really badly deteriorated. I was there last summer, and I noticed that the light was streaming in all over the place. There were huge holes all over, and it looked like a good strong wind might just blow that building over, but in fact, having a look at those trusses, they look as good as new. In fact, I suspect that as long as those wooden trusses are there, that building is going to remain standing.
So impressive, that engineering feat that they managed to come up with
all
those
years ago. Well, especially this idea that you could just use glue to replace nails. That's pretty neat.
Gordon, what's for next week?
Well, a few weeks ago, listeners may recall that I said we're going to broaden this series occasionally to consider other aspects of abandonment, not just buildings. And so, for example, I talked about the practice of charivari. Well, next week, we're going to talk about a cultural practice that, well, hasn't yet been fully abandoned, but it is dying.
There you go. Looking forward to it, Gordon. Thank you.
See you next week, Nadia.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.